This is Ask a Biologist, a programme about the living world, and I'm Pauline Davies, sitting in for Dr. Biology, who's out of the country exploring some fascinating new projects that he'll talk about on a later show. But today we're celebrating youngsters who've been given awards by the Association of Women in Science. And it's wonderful to have two of these young people here in the Grassroots studio with me. Tell me your names.
I'm C.G. Schultz, and I'm 11, and my project was proving Pick's theorem using lattice-aligned polygons. I like doing math because it's like one of my favorite subjects in school, and I like doing mental math as well. So I thought that would be kind of a good project for me.
Great. And we've got Jessica.
Yes, I'm Jessica Matthews. I am 12 years old. I go to Paragon Science Academy, and my project was on magnets and whether or not temperature, like hot and cold, affects the magnetic force field of the magnet. So I took paper clips, small, they were steel, and I laid them out on a flat surface, and I took the magnets and I put them in different temperatures and different climates, such as a refrigerator at, say, 32 degrees. And I made sure I checked the temperature, and I grazed over the paper clips that were on the flat surface, and I put them in a bowl so I could count them. And I put the magnet back in the refrigerator, and I counted them and I recorded it, and I did that 10 times for different climates, and I have come to the conclusion that yes, temperature does affect the magnetic field. Colder temperatures bring on more paper clips because you know how when you have a solid, liquid, and gas, how the particles create a solid because they're compacted together because it's colder? Well, it brings more paper clips because it's colder, and so they come together more so they can create their own heat, and it gets more paper clips.
Well done. Well, I hope you're going to enjoy your day here at ASU. Yes. I think it's going to be really exciting. Well, also with us is someone the students have been very excited to meet, Dr. Kiona Ogle, a professor and researcher here in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. Welcome, Kiona.
It's good to be here.
So, girls, have you got any questions for Kiona?
How would you describe yourself as an ecologist?
An ecologist?
Yes.
I consider myself a mathematical ecologist that does plant and ecosystem ecology and desert ecosystems, and a lot of stuff I do combines ecology with mathematics. So I actually started out your age or younger very interested in the math, and then I developed that into interest in biology as a way to apply my math skills.
I want to know, what is an ecologist?
An ecologist studies how organisms, plants and animals, me in particular plants, interact with their environments and how the environment affects them in terms of their physiology, their growth, their population dynamics.
Jessica?
So, yes. So with climate change, how does that affect certain plants and animals?
Well, I know a lot more about plants, and there's in the scientific literature regarding animals, there's predictions that, you know, certain species may go extinct because of changes in their environment, like elevated temperature might affect some species more than others. There's the same idea with plants, too, that it might affect some species more than others, so it's not very clear how to predict what will happen in particular, but the idea is that we might see shifts in what we call species community composition, so some species do a lot better under elevated carbon dioxide, increased temperature, changes in rainfall, and other species may be outcompeted. They don't do as well, and they could potentially go extinct. But the exactly what will happen, we're still not sure. It's unpredictable.
So when you're saying some species are going to go extinct, do you know exactly what species? Or?
No, I mean, I can't name particular species, but the idea is that species that are more sensitive to environmental conditions, if you increase the temperature by 5 or 10 degrees, some species may be harmed more than others because they can't tolerate extreme temperatures, like here in the desert. If it increases by 5 more degrees and we have summers of 120 degrees, you might see temperature-sensitive species that might go extinct.
How can you preserve those certain species?
That's a good question. You have to change the environment, or you change the species, the DNA potentially of the species, and such that you might find certain genotypes that do better under different conditions. where other genotypes have a certain combination of DNA might be more susceptible. So within a species, different individuals might be less susceptible to climate change than others. And so you could target those that are hardier as ones that could potentially be conserved to keep the population viable.
Would you feel bad about changing the DNA of the species?
Oh, so maybe I didn't use the correct words. You could change the genetic composition not by going in there and actually using molecular ways to change it, but you could, the population could shift towards individuals that already are in the population but that do well. So certain genotypes might do well. So you may not actually change the DNA itself.
So it would just be natural selection.
Yeah. Helped by man.
Right.
Helped by us.
Why did you choose to study plants instead of animals?
I find animals very interesting too, but they're difficult to study, for one thing, because they move around and you have to have special permits often to study animals. But I also am just fascinated by plants, especially desert plants. They're very pretty, and if we didn't have plants, none of us would be alive because they produce the oxygen that we breathe. And they're very easy to study because they're there, they don't move, you can make all sorts of measurements on them. You can manipulate them very easily.
Do you think the desert is a good place to do what you're doing?
I personally do. I love the desert. Other people might find other ecosystems more interesting, but I am particularly interested in how changes in rainfall might affect desert plants and ecosystems. And we're seeing changes in rainfall patterns due to climate change. And deserts are very extreme environments in terms of temperature and water availability. So they are a good place to study sort of the effects of these extreme climate changes that we might see.
Okay. So you're saying you're interested in certain ecosystems such as the desert and in plants. Well, have you always been interested? Like when you were a child, did you know you were going to be an ecologist?
No, I thought I might be either a graphic artist or a math teacher. But I grew up on in a very rural area on a farm, sort of. So I was always outside interacting with plants and the environment. And I developed an interest more probably about in high school. And then in college, I really decided to become an ecologist after about 2 years in college. So it was more of a gradual. I realized I really like this, so I might as well study it.
That's good.
What would you like to be, Jessica?
I don't know. I'm kind of still deciding because certain people know what they want to be, but others don't. They take a long time to decide. So I don't know.
Well, what are your favorite subjects?
All of them. I like school a lot, so I'm very interested in math and science and technology and engineering. So I could be an engineer, I could be a singer or an artist or anything, really.
How about you, CG?
I would like to become a math professor when I grow up because I've always really had an interest in math, and by the time I'm in eighth grade, I'll have all my high school math done. So I just thought it would be really fun to become a math professor and teach kids about math and different things. So
that's a great ambition. Do you have any idea what sort of mathematician you would like to be? Would you like to study problems in the real world, or would you like to do math for its own sake?
Study math in the real world, I guess, because it sounds like really fun to do that.
I remember when I was in high school, I took a calculus class. Have you had calculus yet?
No.
Okay. But we had a problem in there that was using calculus methods to figure out when somebody died based upon the change in their temperature. And I thought that was a very interesting problem when I was in high school, and I realized that there's many applications of math to biological problems, you know, real-world applications that made it kind of exciting.
That sounds really cool, what you did in high school.
Yeah.
I want to do that now.
You'll get there soon enough.
Well, I can't let you go without asking about, in fact, I'll ask you all, what do you think about the golf courses all around the Phoenix area? They take up a lot of water, don't they?
They probably do. But they are also using reclaimed water, so I'm torn about them. I don't think they belong in the desert, but then they're using water we don't use elsewhere, really.
Right. What about you, girls?
Well, personally, I don't like golfing. It's not one of my favorite hobbies. But I think that it does use a lot of water that, yes, we may not use the water, but it could also be used in different areas. So they're good and bad. they like have different sides.
And CG?
I like golf, but I don't do it as often as I used to, but I also agree with Jessica because they could be used for good things, but they also could be used for bad things as well. So,
well, I read a study recently that I used for my ecology class that looked at bird diversity in different urban habitats, and golf courses were one of the urban habitats that supported the highest bird diversity. So that's a good, potentially a good component of it, even though I'm not advocating lots of golf courses everywhere.
So as an ecologist, you've got mixed views.
Yes. I'm more on the side that I wish that there were fewer, but I think we have a lot here in the valley.
Yeah, we do.
Well, that's been fantastic, girls. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Ask a Biologist, and with me have been schoolgirls C.G. Schultz and Jessica Matthews, winners of awards given by the Association of Women in Science. Together we've been talking to environmentalist and ecologist Dr. Kiona Ogle. And I'm Pauline Davies, standing in for Dr. Biology, who is trekking around the rainforests of Panama, recording the sounds of animals to bring to you in a future programme. Today, though, we're honouring young people who've been given awards by the Association of Women in Science, and I'm delighted to have with me three of those young people. Tell me about yourselves. Farah?
I'm 12 years old, and I go to Basis Chandler. The project I did, which I won the award for, was using nitrifying bacteria to clear out ammonia and nitrate from lake water to help the fish.
Wow, Farah. And what's your second name, just so that everyone knows who you are?
Farah Atohami.
Okay, and Amanda?
Hi, I'm Amanda Benedetto, and I'm 11 years old. My project was Can Roaches Learn? I ran roaches in a maze that I constructed myself that it looks almost like a pitchfork with it's a Y with another end point in the middle, and I wanted to see if they learned because I put food in one of the endpoints and I ran them through, and if they learned, learning would be if they went in faster each time and found the food. But some roaches also went to different endpoints without the food and called that their favorite spot and went there faster and faster.
That sounds absolutely fascinating and a lot of fun. Did you enjoy doing that project?
Yes, I did. I like bugs a lot.
Well, let's see what Sarah has to say.
I am a sophomore, 16 years old, at Xavier College Prep, and I did my experiments by creating an alternative emergency food product by using lentil rice, which is a traditional Middle Eastern dish, and I tested the antimicrobial activity of three different spices, cinnamon, allspice, and cardamom, on the shelf life of the EFP. And I ran it over 6 weeks and stored it at room temperature in my own house and tested.
And what did you find? What was the answer?
Cinnamon yielded the greatest antimicrobial activity, and the EFP ran, it's still going strong after 6 weeks. So I hope to test it in a food lab one day.
So do you think I should add cinnamon to things that I've got at home if cinnamon is the right sort of flavor?
For palatability, sure, and for shelf life, it depends.
Well, it's a good thing to try, I think, anyhow. And together, we're going to be interviewing one of the most inspiring young researchers in the School of Life Sciences here at Arizona State University. Welcome, Susan Holacek.
Welcome, girls. I'm very happy to see you and some of you again. Welcome back. I just graduated in December with a PhD degree in molecular and cellular biology. So I moved from one virus lab to the immunology lab. I'm very happy to talk about my research with you. So if you have any questions, please come on.
But first of all, Susan, what do you think of the girls' projects?
They are amazing. I mean, I already heard so many things about you. I unfortunately didn't have the time to be a judge this year, but I was a judge last year, and the projects are just unbelievable. I already know that some people in biodesign are very interested in your results, so if you're looking for any high school internships, yes, let us know. Yeah. You girls are welcome. You are stars.
I'm planning on becoming a biologist, so maybe I could go and do an internship.
Perfect.
And how did you think of your projects? Was it the school that advised you, your teachers, or did you all come up with them yourself?
Well, I was always inspired by environmental projects, but Our school, they said our science fair project, they would only give us 1 week or a couple of days so we could get the idea. So I had to do it really quickly. So my mother and I, we found the idea online. Even though it looked very complicated, I thought I would take the chance to do it because I was always interested in environmental projects, as I said before, and I wanted to make a big change. I decided to choose it.
And Amanda?
I've always liked bugs ever since I was born. When I was a baby, I've always played with bugs. And when I grow up, I would like to be an entomologist. I've always been inspired by them. So every science fair, I've used bugs with my projects. Last year, I used mealworms and beetles and used their metamorphosis. But this year, I used Madagascar hissing cockroaches.
Where did you get those?
There was a store in Mesa called the Reptile Center, and I got them there.
Right.
A buck each.
So your parents don't mind you having these strange bugs at home?
No, my dad actually approves it, and my mom, she's kind of scared of them, but she says it's okay.
Great project. And Sarah?
I was watching a late-night CNN special on Anderson Cooper about the food famine latest and drought in Somalia, and they're showing the EFPs that they use, which is a paste-like substance that must be very unpalatable.
EFPs, what are they?
Emergency food products that they use in times of low food supply in remote areas, and so I got to thinking, and then I'm in the Accelerate Science program at my own school, so I started working on my project.
Cool. Now, have you got some questions for Susan?
Yes.
Go on, Amanda.
What's the difference between the dengue fever and the hemorrhagic fever?
Okay, so both are diseases, and both of them are transmitted by the same virus, dengue virus. Now we have 4 different kinds of dengue. We call it dengue serotypes, dengue 1, 2, 3, and 4. Dengue fever would be somebody that gets bitten by a mosquito. So it's a mosquito-transmitted disease. The mosquito bites you, and then you may have a mild fever. What happens is that then maybe 1 month later, there's another mosquito that bites you with another dengue. Let's say in this case, dengue 2. Now you have both serotypes in your body, right? They are dengue 1 and dengue 2. So the probabilities that you're going to get dengue hemorrhagic fever are higher, especially for children under 15 years old. So that's what's the big, big problem.
Mm. So you're obviously a specialist on dengue fever. So what are the consequences of getting hemorrhagic fever?
So I'm from Peru, and when I was working there at the NIH, we have the first dengue, hemorrhagic fever dengue outbreak ever. So I was like overseeing like thousands of people getting the disease, and there were a lot of children that get the disease, and there was even a 6-year-old girl that died with complication. The problem with hemorrhagic fever is like when you're so young, you know, you don't have a lot of immune defenses, and you can die like in 4 days. So it's a big problem.
Was there a scientist in Peru that was planning on curing dengue fever like you did that inspired you?
It was very interesting. So I did my biology degree in Peru, and then I was invited to work at the NIH, at a very young age. And when you're at the NIH, you have to work with diseases that make an impact in your country. So being in Peru, and dengue was a very important disease, although at the time we didn't have any hemorrhagic fever, you know, it was still very important because we didn't know what kind of dengue it was, and we didn't know the genotype, so yes, more going into this, in the genomic sequence of the virus. So when the dengue hemorrhagic fever appeared for the first time ever in 2000, you know, I was part of the multidisciplinary group that went, and we looked at the people that were, you know, in the hospitals. It was just crazy. So unfortunately, here in the States, we have the mosquito that transmits the virus in more than 28 states. And Mexico has dengue 1, 2, 3, and 4. So you girls do the math, we better be aware and, you know, have to have a prevention plan in place. Because when the disease hits you, there is no way back. And there is no vaccine. That's the problem. There is no vaccine for dengue.
So you're going to work on the vaccine?
We're working right now. I just finished my PhD. There are not a lot of scientists working with dengue in the States, and it's because we don't have the disease, right? There was an outbreak a couple of years ago in Florida with dengue 1, but there are not many people. So in order for us to start, like, really working in the project, we need to get a lot of approval. We need to get the virus. We get to get the animal models or whatever it is that we need. So that takes some time, and I just graduated, so I'm doing my best.
And I've noticed that you're working with both molecular biology and advanced mathematics, and I was just wondering how you can integrate these two in order to predict the outcomes of dengue fever and outbreaks.
So that's an excellent question, and that's something that I would like to advise to you. Right now we're in the world of interdisciplinary work, so you girls, if you can like team up with somebody if you're interested in ecology, you should team up with somebody in molecular biology. See, these interdisciplinary groups are very valuable. So the way I started working with math, although I'm not a mathematician, was when I met an ex-collaborator, and David Murillo. He already left at ESU, but I'm still working with the math department here. He had a big interest in dengue. I have a huge interest in dengue. So he was doing mathematical models. I used to do molecular biology in Peru. That was what I did for 5 years there. So we decided, okay, what if we can look into what are the variables, you know, what mosquitoes, and if there are different serotypes, as I mentioned, 1, 2, 3, and 4, if there is a predisposition for a specific serotype to be transmitted at a higher rate. Okay, so then that's where mathematics go into place, and you should see these complicated models that they created, and, you know, we're going to publish a paper, we're working on it in maybe 3 months for a conference. So it gives me a different perspective, and I think that was a very valuable trait, because that's what got me my postdoc right now. Because my advisor, Dr. Blattman, he's very interested also in the immunology and the math part, and it's because of my background, because I'm not afraid of math. That's how I got the position. So it's very valuable for you girls to try to collaborate with other people in different fields.
What's the best thing about your work? What do you enjoy most?
Okay, this is great. Every day is different. Every day is a challenge. And in science, you have to be ready to fail. And that's how you learn. Is when you experiment, it won't work the first time. It may not work the second. It will not work. But when it works, you celebrate. And every day is different. It's not a sitting down in a desk and doing the same job every day. It's like you're in the lab, then you're in the computer, you're running your samples, you're ordering, you're planning ahead, you're writing a grant or you're writing your paper, your results. So it's so exciting. Every day is so different. So I love it about it.
So you find being a scientist is very unique and not boring in the job. So were there any hobbies that motivated you to being a scientist?
Well, it was funny because I told my dad I wanted to be a scientist, I think when I was 6 years old. So he kept buying me these microscopes and science books and stuff. So I didn't have the time like to go into music when I was little, I wish, but I love painting. So, and I think being an artist kind of as a hobby helped me a lot, because when you're working with like tiny things, it's kind of you have that art in your fingers, you know, you had a nice strike.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, since art is also my talent, so, like, whenever I do science, it reminds me of art, since art is unique and it's your way.
Yes.
You can think of any idea you want, you can turn it to reality.
Exactly. It's your way of expressing what you want, and you're going to be finding that art is a great hobby to have if you're a scientist.
So, if you weren't a scientist, what would you be?
Oh, my gosh. When I was little, I was between being an astronaut, who was discarded that because I can't know now, and I was very interested in archaeology. So the country where I'm from, Peru, is so rich. I mean, if you girls hear about Machu Picchu, those ruins are amazing. I've been there like 5 times, and it's so rich. The culture is so rich there that if you're an archaeologist in Peru, I mean, that would be great. That was my second choice.
Sarah, what would you like to be?
I do not know. My dad is in internal medicine, but then I've gotten an increasing like between integrating social issues and biology. So I don't know. I have a few years to decide.
Right. Amanda?
I just want to stick with being an entomologist because I think that bugs are interesting and they can transmit diseases and sometimes they can cure them if you get the right sort of motivation. Because I heard that there was a certain type of ant, and if they took some of the venom out and ejected it into a person that was sick with something, I forget what it was, but it cured them. But they used the venom from the ant on one person, and then on the other person they added a few things to the venom to make it an antidote.
Well, I think that's a fantastic motivation for your career in the future. Don't you agree, Susan?
It's perfect because in dengue, as I mentioned before, it's transmitted by mosquitoes. So I have like 1 year of entomology also training. And I just went to Costa Rica last year, and that was very useful because I had to determine, you know, is this the right species of mosquito or not? So I had to use my entomology skills. So that's amazing. I love it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you all, Susan.
Thank
and
you so much.
The girls.
Yes.
It was great fun talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Ask a Biologist. In the studio have been award-winning youngsters Farah El-Tahami, Amanda Benedetto, and Sarah Saka. We've been chatting with infectious disease biologist Dr. Susan Holacek. The Ask a Biology podcast is produced at the campus of Arizona State University and is recorded in the Grassroots Studio, housed in the School of Life Sciences, which is a division of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And remember, even though our program is not broadcast live, you can still send us your questions about biology using our companion website. The address is askabiologist.asu.edu, or you can just Google the words Ask a Biologist. I'm Pauline Davies.